This is the second time that I've ever given a talk from a laptop. So far it's going okay, but if something odd happens in the middle, such is life. Okay, so take a black hole and drop in a box of gas. In your initial state, you have a box of gas, which has a lot of entropy, and a black hole. In your final state, you have a slightly bigger black hole and nothing else. If the second law of thermodynamics is not going to be violated, that slightly bigger black hole had better have enough extra entropy to make up for the entropy lost from the gas. Using much more precise arguments of this sort, about 35 years ago, Bekenstein argued that black holes should have an entropy proportional to the surface area of their horizon. And a couple of years later, Hawking showed that this was correct, or at least all self-consistent, because black holes radiated as black bodies with characteristic temperatures proportional to the surface gravity and entropies of exactly the form that Bekenstein had suggested, proportional to the horizon area in Planck units. Now, in every other system we know in nature, thermodynamic behavior reflects the physics of microscopic states. And if there is any justice in the world, this should be true for black holes as well. If that's true, it could be important because the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy involves Planck's constant and Newton's constant, and so is at least in some sense a quantum gravitational quantity. And so we might hope that this thermodynamic behavior could tell us something about quantum gravity. Now, for most of the 35 years that we've known these formulas, if you had asked people in the field what these microscopic states were, you would have gotten pretty much the same answer from everybody, namely, we don't know. There were some vague ideas floating around about entanglement between states inside and outside the horizon, and there were some very simple artificial models of states on a black hole horizon, but it was pretty clear that nobody really understood the microscopic behavior here. In the past 10 years or so, this has changed drastically, and you can now find a large number of people who will tell you with great confidence and with great detail exactly what states are responsible for this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. The problem is that while many people are certain, they don't all agree. There are at least three explanations within string theory. The original one described counted states in terms of weakly coupled D-brains wrapped around cycles in a compact manifold with a number that was protected by supersymmetry or somehow protected even without supersymmetry when you went to strong coupling to get real black holes. There was a much more recent, related but certainly not obviously equivalent version of this, looking at strong couplings and having a picture of very complex geometries without horizons, but which in some sense on the average give you a black hole with a horizon. And then with the anti-de Sitter conformal field theory duality, there's another way of counting these states in string theory as states of a dual conformal field theory that in some sense lives at infinity. Within loop quantum gravity, there are at least two ways of counting these states, not obviously equivalent. One looks at states of a spin network, states on the horizon induced by a spin network with an action that is determined by as a boundary term of the ordinary gravitational action. A second one counts equivalence classes of states inside the horizon. There is a way of counting states using an old idea of Sakharov of induced quantum gravity, in which the Einstein-Hilbert action is not fundamental, in which you have an action in which there isn't an action for matter in which there isn't a gravitational action, and the gravitational action is induced when you integrate out heavy degrees of freedom. If you choose those heavy degrees of freedom in a way that gives you a finite cosmological constant and a finite value of Newton's constant in the induced theory, you can go back and count the heavy states, and you get the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. There is recent work in what's called the causal set approach to quantum gravity, which considers space-time to be an approximation of a discrete set with fixed causal relations between points, in which you count the number of points in a certain future of the horizon. And again, you get at least a quantity with a not exactly determined prefactor yet, but the right order of magnitude proportional to the horizon area. There is the old idea of entanglement entropy, that you can count states by looking at correlations between the exterior and the interior of the black hole. That gives entropy of the right form, but in a way that needs to be renormalized. But there's been very recent work on a holographic version of this that seems to give the correct Bekenstein-Hawking entropy without any ambiguity in any factors. There's an old argument of Hawking and Hunter's that you shouldn't count microscopic states because, at least in some derivations of the entropy, it's determined by large-scale global properties of the geometry and not properties of the horizon itself. And then, of course, you have to worry about Hawking's original derivation, which was based on quantum field theory in a fixed curved space-time background, which didn't know anything about quantum gravitational degrees of freedom in any obvious way, at least. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a nice, healthy debate about what the microscopic quantum gravitational picture of black hole entropy is. After all, we don't have a correct, universally accepted theory of quantum gravity, so we ought to be arguing about this. There is something wrong when everybody gets the same answer. If you're a complete cynic, you can say that people get the same answer because they know what the answer is supposed to be. But even if you want to reject all but one of these explanations, you still have to explain why it gives the same answer as Hawking's original calculation that didn't know anything about quantum gravity. Even within string theory, for example, this problem of universality exists. The way that you count, the way that you determine entropy in the weakly coupled approximation of string theory is not by doing a calculation that gives you the horizon area. What you have to do is take a black hole with some set of charges and masses and determine the entropy in terms of the charges, determine the area in terms of the charges, then go back and see that they match. Then I come along and say, oh, did I say four dimensions, three charges? I really meant five dimensions, four charges. You can't just say, well, it's a quarter of the area. You have to go back and recalculate the entropy and recalculate the area in terms of the new set of charges. You get the right answer again. There's something going on here that we don't understand. So the main question that I want to talk about is whether there is some underlying mechanism that can explain why everybody's getting the same answer. And since it's hard to think of anything that all of these approaches have in common except for fundamental symmetries, it's natural to ask whether there's a symmetry that somehow determines the density of states, the entropy of a black hole. Now, that seems to be a lot to ask for a symmetry, but there's one case in which we know that this works. If you have a two-dimensional conformal field theory, basically any two-dimensional theory that's invariant under diffeomorphisms and rescalings of the metric, then the basic symmetry is generated, is the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic diffeomorphisms, which are generated by what are called the Virasoro generators, L and L bar. In any quantum version of such a two-dimensional conformal field theory, the commutators of these generators is determined almost uniquely. The first term on the right-hand side here is just the ordinary commutator of diffeomorphisms, that just what you get when you compose two diffeomorphisms. The second term is the unique central extension of this algebra. So unless you're willing to very drastically change the classical symmetry of the theory, you're forced into this algebra. And this algebra is unique up to a single constant C called the central charge. Now, a conformal field theory has symmetries, diffeomorphisms, and like the kinds of theories we're used to, it has corresponding conserved charges, which in this case are just the zero modes of these Virasoro generators. These are roughly the two-dimensional equivalents of energy. In 1986, Cardy discovered a really remarkable result, which is that if you have any conformal field theory with a few minor conditions for it to be a sensible theory, that has to be unitary, and you're given its central charge, and you're given the lowest eigenvalue of this energy, L-naught, then for large values of the energy, this conformal energy, the density of states is determined uniquely in terms of the central charge and the lowest value of the energy, independent of any other details of the theory. This is, I think, one of the most amazing results around, and it ought to have a deep physical explanation that you can draw pictures of. I don't know of such an explanation, and I've asked a lot of people, no one does, who I've found yet. I know how to prove it. The proof involves using a funny kind of duality between high energy and low energy states in a conformal field theory. There ought to be some better, more intuitive reason why this is true. But in any case, it certainly is true. Now, this doesn't seem to be in any obvious way relevant to black holes, because after all, we're interested in black holes that are not two-dimensional and in general are not scale invariant or conformally invariant. But near the horizon of a black hole, there's pretty good evidence that the black hole looks approximately two-dimensional and approximately scale invariant. For example, if you look at a scalar field in a black hole background, you get a conformal piece, one that this piece really is scale invariant, it has no masses. And then you get pieces that are redshifted away relative to this conformally invariant piece, at least as observed by an observer outside the horizon. The same kinds of arguments can be made for all sorts of fields, including the gravitational field itself. There are some nice general results that a generic black hole has a conformal symmetry near its horizon. And you can use this essential reduction to two dimensions. In the past year or so, originally Wilczek and Robinson and then a bunch of other people have showed that you can use this two-dimensional picture and the conformal invariance and the central charge to obtain the Hawking flux of a large number of different black holes. And as Iso, Morita, and Umetsu showed, you can even obtain the whole black body Hawking spectrum from this picture. So maybe there's something here that can tell us some fundamental property of the degrees of freedom of a black hole. One way to get out of the, to get information about this, to look at a simple model, is to look at the 2 plus 1 dimensional black hole, the two spatial dimensions plus time. This is called the Banyados Teitelbaum Zanelli or BTZ black hole. It is a standard black hole in the sense that it has an ordinary horizon. It has a Penrose diagram that looks the same as an ordinary rotating black hole in asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. It has an entropy which is a quarter of the area. Well, here the area is just the circumference, the length of the horizon. But in 2 plus 1 dimensions, gravity has no propagating degrees of freedom. So there is something a bit confusing here. We want to say we have this entropy that's due to gravitational degrees of freedom, but in three space-time dimensions, there are no gravitational waves. There's no way for gravitational field to propagate freely. You have only a finite number of total degrees of freedom. So it's worth asking how you can get a microscopic picture of the entropy at all in this case. The answer, which was discovered independently by Strominger and by Birmingham, Sachs, and Sen, let me think the best way to say this. Well, first of all, the 2 plus 1 dimensional black hole is asymptotically anti-de Sitter. That means that infinity has the topology of a cylinder, a circle across time, and has the geometry of a flat cylinder. So it's not surprising that the asymptotic symmetries of this black hole are the symmetries of a flat cylinder, that is, just the diffeomorphisms of a flat cylinder. That's exactly the setting where you expect conformal invariance and conformal field theory to be relevant. It is less obvious, but it was shown by Brown and Teitelbaum, actually before they even knew that there was a black hole solution, that the resulting symmetry algebra, the Virasoro algebra at infinity, has a non-zero central charge. If you plug that central charge into the Carty formula, you get the correct entropy for the BTZ black hole. Where this comes from, roughly speaking, is that the boundary conditions restrict the possible diffeomorphisms. You have to say that the metric approaches some fixed asymptotic form to have a well-defined action principle in general relativity at all. Fixing that asymptotic form means that you're partially breaking the diffeomorphism invariance at the boundary. As a result, the transformations that would like to be diffeomorphisms, that would like to be invariances of the theory, become dynamical at the boundary. So even though you have no propagating degrees of freedom in the bulk here, you do have an induced non-trivial two-dimensional theory at infinity, at this boundary at infinity. And you can, in various ways and with various amounts of hand-waving, count up the degrees of freedom of that theory and recover the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. This was probably the first known case of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and it was known before anybody had any idea that there was a more general relation here. This is not easy to generalize. for a couple of reasons. One is that the fact that the BTZ black hole is three-dimensional is what gives it a two-dimensional boundary. If you go to higher dimensions, you get higher dimensional boundaries, but there's no known believable analog of the Cardy formula in higher dimensions. There are various speculative ideas, but nothing that can be shown to really be true. Beyond that, in more than 2+1 dimensions, you do have propagating degrees of freedom. And so looking at infinity is going to be kind of confusing, because, for instance, you won't know the difference between a black hole and seven black holes and a star, say. But there's still some ideas that you might hope to generalize. This idea that boundary conditions, or that somehow you're breaking the symmetries of the full theory, that's resulting in new degrees of freedom becoming dynamical. Before going on any further than that, it is worth taking a step back and asking a fundamental question that really doesn't get the attention that it deserves, which is the question of how you ask a question about a black hole in a real quantum theory of gravity. Normally, people don't pay attention to this because normally people don't deal with the full quantum theory of gravity. They deal with some approximate quantization around a fixed background. And so then you just say, well, take your fixed background to be a black hole. What more is there to it? But of course, in real quantum gravity, you can't do that. The components of the metric don't commute. You can't just specify all of them. And so you have to worry a little bit about how you know that the thing that you're looking at is a black hole and not something completely different. In other words, you have to figure out how to ask a question of conditional probability, that given some condition that you are satisfied tells you that there's a black hole present, then what is the probability of, for instance, having some temperature of Hawking radiation? To do this, you have to figure out how to impose the existence of a black hole without having the metric as some classical object that you can just say, well, it's a black hole metric. Roughly speaking, there are three ways of doing this. One, the way that I described with the BTZ black hole, is just to impose boundary conditions at infinity. For 2+1 dimensions, that's okay, because there isn't anything except a black hole as an exact solution of the classical field equations with these appropriate boundary conditions. So even there, once you put in matter, you have to worry that you're getting the same entropy for a black hole and for certain configurations of scalar fields, for example, that aren't black holes. Second way to do this is to impose boundary conditions, in quotes, at the horizon. That is to say that fields, to pick out some surface and say that this is a horizon in the sense that fields at this surface have to obey some conditions. For example, that the metric has to have zero expansion, which is the standard definition of a horizon. This approach, a number of people, including me, have worked on this for a few years now, and you can get some interesting results. You can get the right Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, but there are some ambiguities about normalizations and about things that blow up at the horizon, and the approach doesn't work for the two-dimensional black hole, which is an important example. So a newer approach, really new, I mean, this year, 2 years, is to take this phrase, take this word constraint literally, and to impose the existence of a horizon as a new constraint or as a new set of constraints, in the sense of constraints in constrained Hamiltonian dynamics, in your quantum theory of gravity. So I'm now going to get a little bit more technical and describe a slightly more detailed model in which this can be done. And then I'm going to go through the details quite quickly, though, mostly just to show you that they exist. I will then show you, or at least show you that it would be possible to show you if I had enough time, that the resulting picture is plausibly a candidate for a universal explanation in the sense that it seems to include some of the explanations that I listed on that first transparency as special cases. So, here's the model. I've argued that near the horizon, the black hole looks effectively two-dimensional. So what I'm going to do is start with general relativity and arbitrary number of dimensions with arbitrary extra fields, if you like, and dimensionally reduce to two dimensions near the horizon. You can certainly do this if you have spherical symmetry, but it turns out that you can do this even without any symmetry. You can do a kind of a Kaluza-Klein reduction even without symmetry. What you get is an enormous gauge group. You get, in this case, some vector fields whose gauge group is the group of diffeomorphisms of the remaining d minus two dimensions. But that's okay. It's still just a lot of two-dimensional vector fields. When you do that, you get an action with some appropriate normalization that looks like this. This is a two-dimensional action. That's the two-dimensional scalar curvature. Phi here, the dilaton, is basically the transverse area. It's the rest of the metric that doesn't live in this RT plane. It will have a potential of some sort, we don't care what, and there will be a bunch of gauge fields, non-abelian in general, we don't care what. Now, ideally what we would like to do now is to put a constraint at the horizon, to say that the horizon is a black hole horizon. That's really hard, because a horizon is a null surface, and when you try to quantize gravity or even do classical Hamiltonian analysis of gravity where your initial surface is null rather than space-like, it gets ugly. This ought to be done at some point, but for now I decided I couldn't face it. I want a student to do it. So what I'm going to do instead is cheat, but in well-established ways. First of all, I'm going to analytically continue to Euclidean signature. What this does, the light cone t squared minus r squared equals 0 gets continued to t squared plus r squared equals 0. So the horizon shrinks to a point. It's easy to check that time then becomes periodic. Time is a circular direction. The radial direction is outward from the horizon. And then I'm going to do a standard trick in string theory, from string theory, although it existed long before that, which is what's called radial quantization, which means that I'm going to start here and look at a Hamiltonian that propagates me outwards in R rather than around the circle in T. So there are standard ways of doing this. You write a metric in a standard ADM form. You read off the set of constraints. As in general relativity, this is a fully constrained theory, the Hamiltonian consists entirely of constraints. The Hamiltonian constraint generates, the diffeomorphism constraint generates transformations along the surface of constant R that you're evolving. The Hamiltonian constraint deforms that surface outward. And there are a bunch of gauge constraints that can be solved exactly and then just plug back in. You combine these to get a Virasoro algebra, not surprising because we've reduced to two dimensions. You work out the algebra and the central charge is zero. But that's okay because we haven't yet said that we want a black hole. So now let's put in some constraints that say that there is a black hole horizon. Again, there's one subtle point here, which is that the horizon is a point, and you can't really specify initial data at a point and evolve outward. You need to specify it on a line if you're in two dimensions. So what you need to do is to specify what's called a stretched horizon. You specify a little circle around that point, something pushed out a little bit from the horizon, then take the limit as that shrinks down to the horizon itself. There is a fairly easy way of doing this in terms of some geometric quantities that I won't go into detail here, the expansion and the surface gravity. But there's a fairly direct way of writing constraints that say that this little circle really is a stretched horizon of a black hole with a specified surface gravity, kH. The problem with these constraints is that they don't commute with the Virasoro generators. That is, they're not invariant. There is, in some ways that's not a problem. In some ways, maybe you should think of that as a good thing, since I've been arguing that the extra degrees of freedom that explain the horizon entropy might come from breaking the symmetry of the theory. But you still, it makes things hard to have these constraints not commute with the Virasoro generators. But there's a standard way of dealing with this that goes back to Bergman and Komar in the 50s, which is that if you have any operator that doesn't commute with the k's, these horizon constraints, you can always define a new one, which is the one you started with plus zero, that is plus multiples of the k's, which are zero, in such a way that, provided that you have some conditions on these constraints, that the Poisson brackets are invertible, when you define a new operator this way, it does commute with the constraints. So you do that, you fix some unknown factors that went into the definition of the constraints by saying that you want the result to be a nice algebra, and you end up with a Virasoro algebra again, but now one with a non-zero central charge. You use the Cardy formula and you find an entropy, a density of states, that is 2 pi times the right answer. Well, I think that's okay, because the states that we want to count are states at a fixed time. But instead, we're counting states on this stretched horizon. And remember, the angular direction here is time. So in some sense, we're taking states over all times. And all times here are a circle, so you get a factor of 2 pi. So I think that's okay. And it's at least pretty close. But now let's get back to this question of universality that I started with. If this mechanism, remember the place that I started was this puzzle that lots of people are counting states to get the entropy in lots of different ways. They're all getting the same answer. So I said, well, maybe there's an underlying symmetry that explains this. But if that's true, then this underlying symmetry had better be hidden somewhere in all of these calculations that everybody else has done. If it is, then I'm right. Then it's settled that we know why the entropy is has this universal expression. If it isn't, then I've just added item number 11 to that list of 10 explanations. And, well, it's always nice to be. I'd rather be number 1 than number 11, but it would be in good company at least. So let's look for evidence that maybe this is a universal explanation. I certainly don't have anything like complete evidence, but I have a couple of pieces. One piece that's pretty strong, and a couple of others that are more preliminary, but that I think are promising. The strong one comes from the ADS-CFT counting of black hole entropy and string theory. The way that this works in almost all examples in string theory in which you can actually calculate the entropy and get a number and not just an order of magnitude. The way that it works is that if you look at these string theory black holes and you look near the horizon they look like the three-dimensional BTZ black hole cross something trivial, something that just goes into renormalizing constants. So if I can show that this horizon analysis is equivalent to the counting of states for the BTZ black hole, then I have essentially shown that it's already the ingredient that has been secretly used in these string theory computations. Well, you make a comparison and you find that things don't match. As I said, the BTZ black hole states can be counted in terms of a conformal field theory at infinity. The central charge for the BTZ black hole is different from the central charge that I found. The conformal weights, these energy, conformal energies, are different for the PVZ black hole than the ones that I found. It turns out, though, that this difference is not really there, that it's illusory, for two reasons. The first is that the moding is different. In order to find the central charge and the conformal weights, you need to have some set of modes that you're looking at in the Virasoro algebra. The modes for the BTZ black hole at infinity are different from the modes for this two-dimensional black hole at the horizon or at the stretched horizon. It turns out that in conformal field theory, there's a standard way of changing the modes from one to another, and it changes the central charge and it changes the conformal weights. So that's change number one. Change number two is that for the original BTZ black hole calculation, you use an angular coordinate that's fixed at infinity, even for a rotating black hole. Well, if you want it dimensionally reduced to two dimensions near the horizon, you ought to use a co-moving angular coordinate. You put those two changes in, you find that the central charge and the conformal weights match perfectly. Okay, so that's one piece of string theory that seems to fit into this framework. Loop quantum gravity, well, this is much vaguer, but the states that are counted, the horizon states that are counted in loop quantum gravity are related to states of an SL2C Chern-Simons theory, with K here as just a coupling constant. A Chern-Simons theory on a manifold with boundary is equivalent to a certain conformal theory on the boundary, and in this case it's something called Liouville theory. If you work out the central charge of that Liouville theory with a natural choice of this parameter gamma called the emergency parameter that nobody understands in loop quantum gravity, you get exactly the same central charge that I'm getting in this horizon constraint approach, except for the two-part really let that go. So there may be something here, but I don't know how to make the connection fully. It's just a hint that a connection there might exist. Now, I said earlier that you can also calculate entropy by treating the horizon as a boundary and putting boundary conditions there. The central charges match there. There's a paper by Emperon and Mateos arguing that you should be able to get normalize this conformal weight, this conformal energy, using something called a Komar integral. That works as well. There ought to be a way of connecting this to the path integral approach. I'm working on that. I think that it should not be too terribly hard because of the way the Cardy formula is derived from path integrals. Finally, let me go back to the question of what this says about the states that are responsible for black hole entropy. Now, in some sense, my argument should tell you that this is the wrong question to ask, because after all, I'm looking for a universal description that explains why theories that are counting very different states are still getting the same answer. So I better not just go and tell you, well, this is what the states really are, because then it doesn't explain why somebody who is counting different states gets the right answer. But this suggests not a fundamental but an effective description of the states that I think might have some significance. Let's go back to general conformal field theory and think about what it means to quantize it. The Virasoro generators, L and L bar, are generators of Diffie morphisms. And those are gauge symmetries. And so normally the way you quantize a theory that has a gauge symmetry is by saying that the states are invariant under this symmetry. That is, that the generators of the symmetry annihilate the physical states. But this relation is not consistent if there's a central charge. If you just look at the commutator of two L's, you get a term involving the central charge and no L, no operator, so it can't be zero. In conformal field theory, we know how to deal with this. We can't impose constraints that are this strong. So instead, for example, we impose constraints that say, for instance, that the positive frequency pieces of the generators of diffeomorphisms annihilate physical states, but that the negative frequency pieces don't. But that means that we have new states. Namely, you start with a vacuum and you act on it with a negative frequency piece of one of these generators. You get a state which would be zero if there were no central charge and we were doing ordinary quantization, but is not zero and is still supposed to be physical given this central charge. In other words, some states that used to be considered non-physical, just pure gauge, pure diffeomorphism states, now have to be counted as physical. This is analogous to, although not exactly equivalent to, the Goldstone mechanism, and Nemanja and John pointed out this analogy to me last year. Just as in the Goldstone mechanism, when you have a symmetry that's broken, the generators of the symmetry now become new physical degrees of freedom. Here you have this symmetry of diffeomorphism invariance at the horizon, which is broken in the weakest way possible by just the existence of a conformal anomaly, but still broken. And as a result, you have new degrees of freedom. It would be nice to connect this with the Cardy formula. I mean, this sounds as if it ought to be the explanation of the Cardy formula, but I don't know how to really show that. But it is at least a possible way of looking at the states responsible for black hole entropy in a way that's universal enough that it explains why different people are getting the same answer. Because again, as in the Goldstone mechanism, you know that there are degrees of freedom, but the exact form of those degrees of freedom in terms of your fundamental fields depends on exactly what field theory you're starting with. So this is universal enough, but that it might explain this mystery of universality. Or might not, but one can hope. So I'll stop there.
Thanks for exploring your interesting work. Are there any questions?
So in Hawking's region of derivation, what's the assumptions? I mean, that all those models maybe because it's consistent, if you want to be consistent with Hawking's derivation, you should get the same answer.
That's true, but it's not an explanation. Let me explain what I mean by that. Consider the thermodynamics of an ideal gas. You have a quantum theory that allows you to write down the states and count them explicitly. And you can work out the entropy, and then you say, oh, look, in the classical limit, this agrees with the entropy that you get from ordinary thermodynamics. There you understand why there's the relationship, because of the correspondence principle, very basic part of quantum mechanics, that says that these quantum states should correspond to classical states, which you then can identify in the, at least in the limit that h bar goes to zero, and then you get quantum corrections. And that's fine. And in that, in a picture like that, you can say that the classical thermodynamics, in some sense, tells you why the quantum theory is giving you the right entropy, because you have a fundamental principle there. For a black hole, things are very different, because a classical black hole has no hair. Classical black hole, there are no states beyond, there's no information beyond the mass, spin, and charge. So there aren't any classical states for which you can apply something like the correspondence principle. So what Hawking did was to show that when you have a black hole in the presence of other fields, that you have certain thermodynamic relations, that the black hole radiates. But because there isn't a correspondence principle, that doesn't allow you to say anything fundamental about the states of the black hole. And in fact, the whole relationship looks very mysterious. I mean, you have Planck's constant appearing from nowhere, if you like. You have Planck's constant appearing because you're looking at quantum field theory in a black hole background, but in a way that doesn't seem related to the black hole itself. So while it's true that any quantum theory had better agree with Hawking's results, it's not clear what mechanism could make any quantum theory agree with Hawking's results. So if you like, what I'm looking for is some underlying mechanism that can force that kind of agreement, because otherwise the agreement just becomes a mystery.
Can I ask a question? You were asked in Santa Barbara when you gave a similar talk, which was, isn't a result that could explain this that you end up with the same low energy Einstein-Hilbert action as the sort of lowest order and then plus quantum corrections? Couldn't that be?
Well, how does that explain it? I mean, again, yes, it's true that any theory that gives you the Einstein-Hilbert action as lowest order ought to agree with Hawking's calculations. But again, that's a statement that doesn't provide a mechanism for the agreement. Right, I mean, it's true, but it's not explanatory. I mean, for example, if you think about the 2 plus 1 dimensional case, you get the Einstein-Hilbert action as the low energy limit of some, say, string theory. But the low energy, in this low energy limit, there are no quantum gravitational degrees of freedom. So you're clearly missing something, and just the fact that if you then put in some field that you can work out the Hawking radiation and you get the right explanation, that's just telling you that you're missing something special, something fundamental. It's telling you that you don't understand what the degrees of freedom are.
This approach by Ashtetar and Lewandowski, perhaps, about isolated horizon and black holes.
Yeah.
This is a relaxation of the demand on horizons.
Yeah.
Can we use this approach in this stuff?
Well, I would hope so. The condition that I used for a stretched horizon was essentially the isolated horizon condition of Ashtekar et al. But since I've continued to Euclidean signature, in order to do that, you have to assume that you're at thermal equilibrium, which means that your horizon is much more strongly restricted than these more general isolated horizons. Again, what I'd like to do is do this in light cone quantization characteristic initial data, in which case presumably the right boundary conditions or the right constraints are isolated horizon conditions.